Right after this, we'll have the Ask the Experts, where you can shout out and ask other very difficult questions to various other people, which is also going to be really interesting. But I think that we can definitely manage talking about a few topics, including security. So going way back, when I still had lots more hair than I do today, I talked about Exchange, primarily about Exchange. Only about Exchange. People called me obsessed by Exchange. I always said people, well, Exchange is my first love, and you know, it will be my last. Little did I know that it would die this quickly. No, just kidding. I did not say that. I'm not being I'm being recorded. Anyway, so over the years, I've learned how to adapt and work with new technologies. And one of the trends that I've observed over the past year and a half, 2 years, it's always been an interesting and very important point. It's becoming increasingly more important is security. Do not like security people. I really don't, because I believe those are dinosaurs, traditional security people. And I think a very nice quote I've ever had, was it Greg Taylor that quoted that? I don't remember, but it was at a conference, and it struck me really interesting because a lot of security people say, no, you can't do this, no, because it's not secure. Well, I strongly believe that security people are not there to stop me from doing things. They should help me doing the same things in a secure way, which is a very different approach to security. So I'm not against security. I'm against the security guard that says, no, you can't do this because it's not secure. I like the security guard that says, well, the way that you did it before is really insecure. How about we do it this way because it's much more secure to do it that way? He didn't block me in doing whatever I needed to do, and he gave me an option to do it more securely. It's a win-win situation, right? So there is a very different approach, and the really good guys, they understand that, but the really traditional old school guys, they tend to fight off and tell you, no, you can't do this. You find another solution. Anyway, securing Office 365, why is it that important? Well, let's just take a few steps back and take a look at the history of what's happened over the past, I'm going to say 20 something years. Right. We started using passwords in the early days of computing that were, you know, 4 or 6 characters, because guessing a 6-character password was really hard. Probably it was less hard for a human to crack a password than it was for a computer to crack the password, or at least it would have taken you less time. But then there is, you know, Moore's law, and says that said, well, you know, the processing power will incrementally increase very rapidly. And so it did. Hardware became more powerful. Very soon, hardware didn't need a lot of time to crack passwords of 4, 6, 8 characters. They could do in a matter of a few seconds if you can do brute force attack. So we needed to start looking for alternatives. The first alternative people told us is use strong passwords because they're much harder to crack. Well, that's true. Giving a certain set of hardware, having to browse through a certain amount of characters more, you're extending the character set from 26 available characters in the alphabet to including numbers, to including other characters, makes it much harder because there are many more combinations of the same password of the same length. But then hardware became more more powerful. So within the same time, they could actually crack the same password, whether it was complex or not. So they said, use longer passwords. Great. Well, there is one problem with longer passwords. It's called humans. I'm not saying there's something wrong with being a human, although I'm one myself, and there's definitely something wrong with me. But we're not made to remember long passwords. Yes, some of us have the ability to remember really, really, really long and complex passwords. Congratulations, you just won the first prize. Unless there is a I can remember a very long password competition and you can actually win some money, there is no value to be found in remembering all those passwords. That's also why there is these password vaults that can help you remember passwords, and you only need to remember one, which in itself is potentially problematic as well. Long story, just to tell you that passwords are outdated in any possible way. Patrick this morning, when he started the keynote, he talked about assuming breach. That is a philosophy to live by. We live in a world where thinking you're safe is stupid. Thinking no one can harm you is even more stupid. Knowing that you are breached or can be breached or will be breached is a better approach, because then you will start reacting or responding in a very different way to those threats. And what I want to talk about just briefly is mentioning all the features that are available in Office 365. And I know Patrick has touched upon them today, but I want to dive in a little bit more and see how they come in together, because reality is there's many, many, many different attack vectors. There is cracking passwords, hacking passwords, there is hijacking, there is spoofing, there is malware, there is viruses, there is social engineering. That's probably the only thing you cannot solve with technology. Here is another great quote. You cannot fight stupidity. Unfortunately, it is true. So there has to be a culture. I mean, if the culture in your organization is to write down passwords on the post-its and put it on the screen, well, you can implement all the safeguards you want, but it will not prevent breaches in any potential other way, as long as the passwords are humanly readable or accessible to anyone else, right? I've had the case with a customer of mine about a year ago. They were concerned about password security, and they've had some campaigns to make people aware they should not put post-its with the password on their screen, nor should they be using their daughter's birthday as a password, or so forth and so on. And they were worried that people, you know, still didn't do it the right way. So they set up a campaign. They hired an external firm that would call in to the colleague, your colleague, and just ask for a password. 30% of those people just handed out their password to someone who called for the password to ask on the phone. Oh, I'm from IT help desk. I'm a new guy. Can you give me your password to log in? Oh, sure. This is my password. 30%. Then they said, wow, 1 in 3 people would just hand out their password if someone called and said, I'm a new guy from IT. Interesting. So they went a step further. They asked some colleagues, malicious colleagues. They said, can you ask your colleague for their password? 76% gave their password directly to their colleague because they could just trust the colleague. Well, imagine this, right? Your identity is the key to your kingdom. Your password is the key to your identity. I have your password. I am you. Now, would you like me to be you? I don't think so, right? No, definitely not. No. I don't want to trade places. But the truth is, I'm a nice guy. Probably once I get your password, I might send out an email saying to everyone that you will buy drinks or host a barbecue and then, you know, have a good laugh and then lock your computer or do stuff, something like that, right? Because I'm genuinely a nice guy and you don't have to believe me. But the truth is, if I were someone malicious and I wanted something from you, then once I have your password without any additional protection, I can do anything you want. I can request something from someone else, pretending it to be you. I can change things that you did. I can get you into trouble. I could go to malicious websites, download malicious things, do things that you wouldn't do, but I did it as you. And you have then to prove that it wasn't you at that point in time. So someone spoofing to be you, and by spoofing, whether it is your digital identity or your personal identity, identity theft is a problem. So you really want to protect that identity, because that identity in itself, our digital identity, is not who we are personally. Obviously it isn't, but it leads to other things. For an organization, it could be IP, intellectual property. That's something that you need to protect, especially if you have R&D departments. You don't want any of those identities to be compromised. And that's why you need additional security measures. So let's take a look, and I'm going to skip over some of these statistics, but it's really a problem that we have, that we face today. Plus, we need to shift from how we've traditionally approached security from an IT perspective into a much different way. We have multiple layers, different layers of where we need to protect identities, we need to protect data, but we need to do it in a different way. Very early on, we said we're going to protect the data room. No one gets into the data room. As a result, no one can get to the data. Great. Well, if I have to travel to the data room to get to my data, then, you know, it isn't very useful. So people invented networks. Great. Well, now the problem is my data is available out of the data room, so I'm going to protect the endpoint, the container, right, where I can access the data. Great, but once I can access that, I'm got, you know, I can freely roam within that system. So protecting the container is only one layer of a protections that you have in your environment, but it's not sufficient. So then we said, okay, let's focus on password complexity. Well, as I said earlier, password complexity is not going to solve the problem. And it is a mismatch with threats. Once I break into your environment, I can take the data, I can take it out. DLP is one way of preventing the data actually leaks from your environment. This is a story I've been told. I believe it was a session we had at Fujitsu a while back where someone from Microsoft, I forget his name, security officer Kyle, right? He came and talked, and he was talking about a customer that had their data leaked. And it's a story that still sticks with me because the data was leaked through LinkedIn, not LinkedIn, Twitter. I was like, how on earth can someone leak data through Twitter? Well, they took data, carved it into, you know, text format, or they hashed it into some form, and then took the data, 130 characters at a time, and started tweeting. Who the hell monitors Twitter? Well, I mean, a lot of people do, but one follower of one account, no one sees that. And they used Twitter to leak data. It took them a long time to tweet out the entire message. But in the end, they were just assembling on the other side all the characters, and then they had the data. Even more interesting, assume breach. That's a number I will never forget. The average, did Patrick talk about how long it takes on average for an organization to find out how long they are breached?
8 months.
Approximately 8 months, 227 days before you know that you've been breached. Well, I invite you, give me the keys to your house for 227 days. Let's see what damage I can do. Anyone up for the challenge? No? Anyway. Two types of organizations, those who have been hacked and those who don't know it yet, which is true. At some point you will. Even, I mean, the lamest excuse that someone can give you is, I've got nothing to hide. Well, great. It's not because you don't have anything to hide that whatever you have in your house isn't interesting or isn't worth having. If it were legal and I could get all the sales data of all my competitors, if I would have any, then I would just be interested in knowing that data. If I would be able to know all their customers, I would be interested in having that data. Is it super state secret? No, but at least it gives me intelligence which I can use against them, right? That's commercial theft. And you can go much further, IP theft, R&D, and so forth and so on. So even though that data might seem at first really unimportant, it can be really critical for your organization and for your organization to survive. So looking at the holistic approach, there's many ways that we can attack or that we can defend ourselves. It's a better way of putting it. Defend ourselves against different or various forms of attack. Protecting the device, securing the data on the device at rest. BitLocker, great example. Who here has a device and has BitLocker on the device? There's still too many people that don't use BitLocker, unless you're using Linux, then it's a different form of BitLocker thingies. I don't do Linux, so I know it's not more secure. So securing data at rest is one item. Data separation. There is a difference between the data that I use for my personal goals and data that I need to use for company goals, right? I don't want to mingle the data. I don't want to take company data home, nor do I want to keep personal data in the company. Well, the other one is probably less important, but me taking company data with me is a problem for the company when I leave the company, because I could abuse the data, even though I have some integrity and I wouldn't. Not everyone is the same thing, right? Accidental leak protection, and I mean accidental. One of the statistics says that 58% of the people already accidentally leaked data to someone else. I've had it this week. Someone copied me in on email, and I was like, wow, I don't even know this guy. What is he even talking about? So I replied back. I'm like, really sorry, but do you have the right Michael? Oh, right. You were right above the other one in the global address list. Sorry. Well, if I were to be malicious, nothing really important in the email, but imagine that it's the CEO sending a mail to CFO about, a new acquisition or, some heads that will roll. Interesting information that I shouldn't have had and now landed in my mailbox just because someone used the wrong name. So DLP, whether it is intentional or accidental, is really important. And there's many layers there. There's the device where you can implement DLP. There is the service, Office 365 DLP policies and so forth, that we can implement to prevent data to be leaked through the various channels. So that is important too. And last but not least, sharing protection. Because regardless of how some security people, and I know I'm bashing them, but they're not here to defend themselves, so that's easy for me. But working in an organization with partners is a collaborative effort. At some point, you have to share data. It's inevitable. There's very little organizations that can only work within their own organization that don't need to share data outside of their organization at some point. However, if you do need to share data, you want to do that in a secure way. Secure doesn't mean that it needs to be hosted on your servers because it's probably not secure at that point in time. Secure means that you need to be able to find a way to securely do that, monitor who access the data, revoke access to the same data without someone else being able to abuse the data, which can easily be done using RMS or Azure Information Protection, automatic classification, protecting the data wherever it goes, regardless of where the data is, whether it's stored offline or online, whether it's on a USB drive or on a hard drive or in Dropbox or a box or anywhere else. That's a great way. You can share it through SharePoint, ShareFile, email. The data is protected at any given time. Or you could set up a system where data cannot be downloaded and can only be viewed off his web apps. Sharing data through SharePoint Online, just give someone an account that they can access the data. The only thing they can do is take a screenshot, perhaps. Yes, well, again, we can't solve all life's problems with just technology because there's just some things that you can't do. But all these things together, if you take the same approach at various layers, then you have a holistic approach to security. And again, that was the message that this morning came. So looking at a few features here, and I do realize the title is missing, but this is Azure Information Protection, right? When looking at Azure Information Protection, it's the newer name for RMS and the classification engine that runs behind. I know Tony talked about automatic classification of data, all that. It's really important because it can help you manage how data is protected. It's location independent, as I said, regardless of where the data lives, gives you granular control. And granular control, typically permissions are you're allowed or you're not allowed to do certain things. You can go a little bit more granular, like in Active Directory. You can allow certain attributes to be written, and you can deny other attributes to be written. But in the end, it's still yes or no. You can do this or you can't do that. Rights management, on the other hand, can allow you to forward or not forward messages, print or not print messages, read or not read messages, save or not save messages, and so forth and so on. The only downside of RMS AIP today is that integration with third-party tools. Natively, Office, beautiful. All the Office applications in Outlook, they work beautiful together with RMS. Even PDF files, Adobe and what's the other one? There's another vendor that does PDF really well. They have PDF writers that can RMS encrypt, and RMS, I mean, literally Microsoft RMS encrypt files natively. Great. But what if I am a photographer and I want to protect my pictures? You cannot RMS encrypt the picture itself. So we need to find another solution. Although it's not ideal, we've got the Azure RMS wrapper, if you will. It's sort of a, I'm going to call it a protected zip file, but it's a wrapper around the file that contains certain rights. So whenever the recipient of that file, which is RMS protected, opens the file, the user rights for that user are being evaluated. For instance, yes, you can view. So the wrapper will allow you to view the attachment within the wrapper. You cannot save. You cannot take the file out of the wrapper. Can they take a screenshot? Yes. So in case of pictures, it's a problem. If you allow them to save the file, then obviously once they are able to take it out of the wrapper, the data is for them and they can do whatever they want to do with the data. Hence why it is less interesting than anything else. But as soon as you start using the wrapper around other file types, you've got traceability. You know who shared it, with whom it was shared, when it was shared, and you can revoke access at that point in time. So there, it does open up some flexibility. It gives you the visibility and control over what you can do to secure the data at that point in time. So I'm going to move over to some other things first here. And I'm going to talk about options in Office 365. So I briefly talked about DLP. I talked about Azure Information Protection. But obviously, there is much more going on in Office 365, and by extension, actually, in Microsoft Online Services. Yes?
How much of your customers use Azure Information
Protection? So today, not many of my customers actively use it because it is fairly new. And fairly new is maybe not the right statement because it's been around for a while. But I have a lot of organizations that are secure conscious, looking at it, testing it, seeing what they can do. There are still some limitations in AIP. One of the things, for instance, is automatic classification. Beautiful if you can make it work. If you've got structured data, automatic classification is a breeze. If you always have the same set of data, then you can create rules that evaluate that same set of data, which could be a form, regex expression. But if you are an artist, or if you create drawings, unless you do metadata on the drawings, it's really hard to classify the data. And then it's up to the end user to use the classification of that data. Now, again, classifying data in, for instance, 3D drawing programs, the Azure Information Protection plugin works in Office, right? So there are still also limitations today, and some third-party vendors can actually solve some of those problems, right? But it is where we are going. So I see a lot of organizations being very interested in what Azure Information Protection can do today, but what it can, will be able to do for you in the future. And this is really interesting because even though not many organizations are actively using it today, or at least from my customer's perspective, and I'm not saying that not many people are using it, it is definitely much better than what RMS used to provision to provide earlier. So I don't know, if, has anyone ever implemented RMS on premises?
No, way too complicated.
There you go. Someone said, yes, I did, and someone said, no, way too complicated. I'm on the no, way too complicated camp. I did it once. I mean, it was okay. If you have the certificate infrastructure that you need, if you set up your, you know, issuing servers and then your downstream issuing service, and I'm not using the right terminology, but it's a lot of work, a lot of servers to make it work. And then you couldn't share outside because that was very limited. So to protect data inside your organization, great. But to share it with external people, you had to give them an internal account, not so great. So as a result, RMS was flawed from the beginning. Not from the idea what it needed to do, but the execution in order to be able to share externally. Because it's now hosted, right? The key management system, the system that hands out licenses that evaluates user rights is now hosted, is externally available. Because of that, sharing is much more flexible. And because of that, even though you might not have the use case today, I do urge you, take a look at AIP. It actually works really well. I use it for my, I mean, I'm a one-man organization. All my data that I write in my documents is protected by AIP. Everything I do is protected by AIP. I can share it with myself, and yes, I can read my own documents, but if my computer ever gets stolen, even though it's BitLocker encrypted, then you can take the data. If you manage to crack BitLocker, great, then you have my data. Well, you can't do anything with the data if you don't have my username and password. And yes, I use multi-factor authentication. So unless you have my device, which I, you know, you can try and take the device from me, you have a problem. You won't easily be able to get to my data. In the end, if someone would, you know, come at me with a gun, take my device, ask my password, ask me to write it down, and then take pictures of whatever I've written, yes, he would probably get my data. But at that point in time, I don't care anymore. He can take all he wants, right? Or she wants. So at that point in time, it's an entirely different discussion. It's not because, you know, you don't see the use case that it can be useful. And if we're all consultants here, where the majority is, it is something that you have to look at. Play with it. See what it can do for you.
I see the use case, and I see that customers also see the use case.
But?
I have chance of being a consultant, and also sometimes make end user sessions,
mm-hmm.
OneNote, OneDrive, that's SharePoint on mine, and sharing. Half of the people who are in these sessions even don't understand that part of yeah. Office 365. I was trying to explain the information protection part, where they have to, the system, decide for themselves, yeah, this file is classified, this file is public accessible, and they have to use the plugins and stuff like that. Well, that was way too difficult for some, for half of the people, and not all, but
I agree. So I'm going to reiterate just what you just said so that people on the webcast and in the recording later know what you were talking about. So yes, AIP, when going out to a customer and demoing AIP, they can see the value in that, but a lot of users complain that it can be too complex because they don't even understand the simple sharing scenarios. And that is true. Even though Microsoft has tried and made AIP very simple, it might seem very complicated. But that all boils down to what Patrick during the keynote talked about is culture. At some point, you know, something's got to give, right? If your users are reluctant to do certain things, if they're not smart enough to click a button, and if they don't know the difference between secret and public, well, arguably, there's nothing much that you can do about that. I'm going to reiterate the statement of you cannot fight stupidity. Now, I'm not going to call all users stupid, but there are certain things that you can't really help. And it's a long process. I agree. I mean, going there, explaining them, this is what you should do, and this is how you should do it, it's probably not. It's going to have to come top down, and you have to slow ease into the adoption. The classification options, there's four options or five options by default. Take away three of them, two options, public, non-public. Start with public, non-public. Yeah, I mean, you know, binary, yes, no. People understand yes, no, typically, hopefully. If not, they're close to retirement. So have them have a very simple option, but use the automatic classification. Public by default. And why use the restrictive way first? Well, imagine I'm a user and I really understand the button yes, no, or public, non-public. And I want to share something with a, you know, someone external, and it's non-public by default, and I forgot about the button, and I share it with him, and he can't open it. I'll quickly learn that I need to click the public button before he can actually see it. That way, I kind of force a certain, you know, automated way of people, oh, yes, I need to click that button if I want to share it externally. It's a culture that you have to cultivate. Right. It's not an easy process. I wholeheartedly agree. It's the most difficult part of implementing technologies, handling the human part there. So for some, in some ways, we're all psychologists then. Not very good at it, I assume, but wholeheartedly agree. And a very good example of the reluctancy or the problem with end users accepting new technologies, multi-factor authentication. What do you mean? I need to press another button or enter a new code. It'll take 2 seconds extra or 20 seconds extra to enter into my computer, but I'm more than happy to walk out and take a 10-minute break to drink my coffee and stay away from work, right? Culture. I've got a lot of organizations that use multi-factor authentication, are very happy with it, they're used to it. I use it all the time. Yes, sure, I have a 5 to 10 second delay whenever I need to approve my login, but I'm used to it, I don't mind. And I've got other customers that just can't stand the fact that they might lose 6 seconds or 10 seconds logging in. That's the human part. It has nothing to do with technology. Sometimes you can't even argue with that. There's no solution that I can give you there. I can only tell you this is technology. Go talk to a psychologist or even, you know, much more than that.
Convincing people that OneDrive actually didn't lead something that is a way past. Not easy, because from their point of view, it's gone, right?
Yeah.
So they have to realize it's actually an application of a library, and that the library still lives in the cloud and has no speech. Most of the trainers that I know don't give that way, and people don't see it that way.
The problem I see with some of the things you just mentioned, right, OneDrive, people don't understand OneDrive. I'm not a big fan of end users having to understand technology in order to use it. Do you know how an engine works? I don't, yet I drive a car. I know it works. I press the ignition button, and then it does vroom, and I can press another thingy, and then it drives. And I've been told how to drive a car, and I've not had an accident in many years, and I'm happy. I don't even remotely care how that works. If it does stops working, I go to the shop and tell them it's broken. Fix it for me. Which is IT support for regular users. I don't think they necessarily need to understand how technology works in order to use technology. In order to do that, technology has to be simple enough to be used. I wholeheartedly agree. And I know that Microsoft sometimes can make things less simple to use than they should, right? I think we're all in agreement there. But we can also all agree that they're trying really hard to make it as easy as possible to use. The problem I see today is for end users, it's confusing. Hell, it's not even end users, it's for us. It's confusing for us. You want to share a document in Office 365. There's 12 ways to Sunday to do that. Let's use a group. Oh no, a team. Why not a distribution list? Oh, SharePoint list. OneDrive, yay. Many ways. Let's upload it to Dropbox or Box or ShareFile or anything else. There's too many options, right? So that is the problem. It's confusing. I mean, in the end users don't understand, don't know what they need to use and how they need to use it. And it all comes down to education, explaining them how to do that, restricting things they shouldn't be doing so that they can do the things that they should do in the right way, and just be patient, explain them this is how you should do that. And sometimes it takes a little while, sometimes it takes them a little longer, sometimes they're really quick, but that's the reality that we live with. Really important there is using the right options for the right use case. Earlier today, I was talking to Tony outside, and we were talking about how some SharePoint adepts see SharePoint as a solution to everything. So they come inside to a customer and tell them, here's SharePoint, what's your problem? Okay, because it solves all the problems to them. I don't wholeheartedly agree. Yes, SharePoint can solve a lot of problems, but in the cloud, there is many other solutions. And I'm saying that everyone is that way, but sometimes SharePoint is the better solution to solve a problem. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's OneDrive. Sometimes attaching an attachment to an email and sending it off is a simple and good solution. You don't necessarily have to do away with that option. I mean, you can still send email and use attachments. I do it all the time. Sometimes I choose to upload an attachment to OneDrive and have that link automatically attached to my email and send it off to someone else so I can track who opened it. Sometimes I don't care, sometimes I do. To me, it's very interesting because I know when to use what. If an end user doesn't know, then just tell them always use OneDrive. Educate them. Explain them why that is. That is one way of dealing with it. But again, it's not a problem that you can solve overnight. It's really culture. You have to have the culture. And it's a long, long process. Now, moving back to some of the things I wanted to talk about is the Enterprise Mobility and Security Suite. Earlier today, I talked about E3. I talked about E5, license plans in Office 365. The majority, however, of the interesting features, interesting from a technology perspective, but interesting from a security perspective, are all part of enterprise mobility and security, which I believe as good consultants is what we should be advocating to our customers. Tell them, yes, I understand it's much more expensive list pricing wise. Maybe you can get discounts, and I'm not a licensing expert, nor am I a sales expert, so I'm not going to talk about what discounts you can get and how to get them, although it's almost end of fiscal at Microsoft. But what you should know is that you sometimes get additional values. We talked about writeback in the previous session, password writeback. It's part of what they call the Azure Active Directory Premium P1, I believe, license, which is part of EMS E3, right? So you can buy that standalone license plan, or you could go for the E3 license plan, which gives you everything in Azure Active Directory Premium P1. I love marketing. Microsoft Intune, Azure Information Protection Premium P1, or Microsoft Advanced Threat Analytics. The latter being a really interesting part because how do you know if you're breached? Suspicious patterns. You have to detect that. Well, in your house, if someone broke into your house, it's usually pretty obvious because they forced the door or anything else. But what if they have a key? You don't know. The door opened, the door closed. You don't know. Unless you have a monitoring solution, a detection system. So detecting is one of the early stages of protecting your environment. Once you detect, you need to be able to respond. So advanced threat analytics can actually take a look at what's happening from an authentication perspective in your environment. But that's detecting, and that's after the fact. If someone broke in, that'll tell you if someone broke in or if there is a suspicious pattern. There's other things that should help you. And if there's one thing that you should take away from today, is that you should use multi-factor authentication. So who dares to admit that you're not using multi-factor authentication today? Really? Really? Everyone else is? Nah, you're all lying. You're all lying, I know you are. No, it's true. I mean, reasonably looking at protecting your identity or anything else, your data is protected by your identity, so if you protect your identity, your data is safer. A password, great. I mentioned earlier that longer passwords are better, and it's true. I mean, a 48-digit password is probably going to be much safer in a certain way because it's going to take a longer time to brute force attack that password than it is going to take to brute force attack a 6- or 8-digit password. The problem is in Office 365, it's not a problem, but the thing is in Office 365, Azure Active Directory, actually, the maximum password length is 16 characters. You cannot go over that. Well, you know, at some point, you'll have to find other things to do. Again, multi-factor authentication on a phone works really well. Have the app on your phone. Yes, it works on Android. It works on iPhone. I've never tried it on Windows Phone. There you go. Is that even a thing still? Windows Mobile, yeah. You switched recently, didn't you? Yeah, I thought so. Ah, there you go. So it works on mobile. It's very, I mean, there isn't much to enabling it. And in order to get our customers to adopt that, showing how it's done is what you should be doing.
Can be enabled for all users at once. Well, yeah, if you do it by PowerShell or check the mode. But I would like, if I create a new user in the tenant, it is automatically MFA enabled.
I believe. I believe you can. PowerShell is one way. Setting the mailbox plan options is another one. And there is a difference between Office 365 MFA and Azure Active Directory MFA. But I do believe that you can actually enable it by default. But don't quote me on that. And if it's not that way, then through provisioning. Yep. If you create the user, enable MFA. If you do this, do that. It's kind of the same on premises when you create a mailbox. You've had these mailbox extension agents, or the commanded extension agents in Exchange that you could write a piece of script that says, whenever a mailbox is created, do this. It's kind of the same thing, right? And you can actually have scripts running all the time to re-enable or have multi-factor authentication enabled. Because, you know, it won't work. Well, it will work, but it'll have to enroll anyway. And there is ways that you can do that. For instance, you can do conditional access in Office 365 where you force using multi-factor authentication. And as such, if they don't have multi-factor authentication enabled or they are not enrolled, they won't be able to access the service that you're trying to access at that point in time. So that's one way of solving a certain solution. But I agree. I mean, there's still some things to be done there. Enable it by default and opt out is a great way, but it will probably piss off a lot of customers, which is probably one of the reasons why Microsoft hasn't done it. But again, I'm not Microsoft, so I'm not going to comment on that. Anyway, moving back to the Enterprise and Mobility Security Suite. So we had ATA, we've got Information Protection, Intune. Now, Intune in itself, I really like it, right? It's not just because it's Intune and it's Microsoft, it's just the value that it brings. Whether you use Intune or a different mobile device management, or device management solution, there is a lot of value to be found because Intune allows you to do conditional access based on the device. If I know the device, I'll let you in. If I don't know the device, I won't let you in, right? It's kind of like join to the Active Directory domain. Obviously, you can do things like join it to an Azure Active Directory domain, but it doesn't give you the management capabilities that Intune does. So in there, in that layer of EMS suites, whether it's E3 or E5, there's a lot of advanced security features that can work together to at various layers, at the detection layer, at the prevention layer, at the response layer, right? So that is again, it's sort of an opera where everything plays its part, and when everything works independently, it sounds horrible, but if it comes together, it sounds great. So an E3 is an absolute minimum from an identity protection perspective because it gives you advanced MFA. Advanced MFA is really important. Why I'm calling it advanced, because it's Azure MFA. Office 365 MFA is for free. Everyone gets it once you get Office 365. So whomever comes back to me and says, well, I couldn't implement it because I don't have the licenses, deserves a slap. Enable it by default, works for all Office 365 services. Generates some other challenges, but should be the one thing that you take out from here. Probably by the end, when I'm done here, you'll hate me for calling out MFA, 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 MFA. But I really want you to go out and be like, crap, he nagged a lot about MFA. I'm going to enable MFA, and I'm happy then. Anyway. So going over the EMS E5, you get some advanced identity protection features. And that's when it really starts becoming interesting, like advanced protection for users, privileged identities. Privileged identities is basically, if you will, some sort of just-in-time management or just-in-time administrative access for your account. So you've got an admin access. I'm not going to grant you the admin access. I am, but you're not able to use them until you need them. And once you them, another administrator needs to prove that you can use your administrative credentials, which means least privileges. Today, the problem is, well, it's not a problem, it's a challenge. A lot of organizations have 20, 30 admins and they all have God mode. That's a problem in itself. 30 people with God mode in your tenants? Oh my God. Pun intended. That's a lot of people. Do they really need that admin access? Maybe they do. But maybe you don't want to activate those admin credentials from the get-go. Maybe they need to get approval first and then activate the credentials for a certain period of time so they can do certain things. This is something that I see getting a lot of traction in highly secured environments, but it doesn't mean that it's not really important for smaller environments as well. Sure, they care less about administration or about security, but your administrative accounts should always be separate to your own accounts. So if someone has an account in Office 365, don't give that account global administrator rights. That account should have user rights, and then they should have a global admin account, just like on-premises. Whose account is actually a user account and a domain admin at the same time? Everyone's quiet?
Home lab.
I can live with that. Tony stands up. So Tony's account is both a domain admin and a user at the same time. Horrible, horrible, horrible people. Anyway, so looking at various strategies, right? It is easy to overcomplicate things. So now I'm taking the other road. I was talking earlier to you about here's all you can do. You should all use all of it. And now I'm going to tell you don't use all of it, or at least don't use all of it at once. From a user adoption perspective, we talked about it earlier. It's really hard to get them to adopt things. So it's really easy to overwhelm them with the options that are available in Office 365. And Microsoft isn't helping. They're releasing stuff at such a rate that it's really hard for us to keep up what we can do today and tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, and then what they revoke and reinstate and all the things they make up. It's really great to see all the capabilities we're given, but you don't have to be overly, enthusiastic about certain features and start implementing them all at once. Start with MFA. It gives you 80% additional security over what you have today. Then talk to your customer. Conditional access is another part of Intune, if you will. part of the EMS suite, which gives you very flexible ways of authenticating to Office 365. And to be honest, previously, if you wanted to do some sort of conditional access, then the only way to do that was through ADFS and using claim rules, custom claim rules. Remember when I said ADFS is great? Well, who can write custom claim rules out of the blue? Come on. Maybe. Well, truth be told, if you can, then wow, horrible. I mean, you have no life. There's lots of examples on the internet, and you can just copy paste. It's a smarter way of doing things. But no, honestly, it's just the language that you use, the claim language that you have to use to write those things. It's really hard. There's lots of examples there, and they can really help you with certain use cases, and they are still needed today. One of the things today is ActiveSync. ActiveSync clients are one of the legacy clients. I know it sounds contradictory, but it's true. They use basic authentication to authenticate your Azure Active Directory. As a result, they cannot take benefit of any of the additional policies that we have that require modern authentication. That's why Microsoft has brought out Outlook client on mobile. The Outlook client can use modern authentication. The only problem, actually, that's not a problem. To me, it's not a problem. I use it all the time. I love it. But for a lot of users, the feedback I get is, well, it's not integrated, because the integrated experience I have on my iPhone or my Android device is the built-in ActiveSync client, but they don't support modern authentication. I do believe that at some point in the future, you know, Android or Apple, they will have modern authentication support. I mean, I just can't understand why they wouldn't have that. So I really foresee that in the future, modern authentication will come for. It wasn't a beta. There you go. So that it is coming, right? But until then, if you are in an environment where you need conditional access for your environment, then you need ADFS if you need to involve these mobile devices. Or you go for a mobile device management solution. Mobile Iron has these sentries called, where you can deploy Sentry internally. The mobile device client, the mobile device makes a sort of VPN connection with that sentry, and that sentry is as a result internally authenticated and then can allow access to Office 365. But conditional access, now moving away from ADFS today, is very flexible because there's two ways of conditional access. You can do that device-based, as I mentioned earlier. You can do a sort of attestation on the device. Is the device secure? Do I know the device? Is there a certificate on the device? Will I allow this endpoint or this client to be used to connect into the service? That's one part of conditional access where you can build really interesting things. And then you've got identity-based conditional access. Do I want that specific user to access the service? Do I want that specific group of users to access the service? More importantly, do I trust that user? And the advanced identity protection features in Office 365 are really interesting. The geolocation-based, or the rules engine, if you will, that evaluates risk behavior. For instance, I log in from Belgium, Leuven, into my mailbox. If I were to, you know, VPN into a device somewhere in New York and authenticate there, I bet you immediately I will be triggered for multi-factor authentication. Why is that? Well, I just traveled across the globe in a few seconds' time. Whereas, unless I'm Santa Claus, there's no way for me to do that, right? Unless I find some really neat way to move quickly. But the system knows that. It can use the machine learning to evaluate risk behavior. I've had it the other day. My mobile phone is connected, no problem. I got on the airplane, well, the other day, it's a few months ago. I got on the airplane, got off the airplane, turned off my phone, prompted me for multi-factor authentication because it said, well, okay, I know the device, I know it's you, but you're logging in from a location that you've never used before. I don't trust that. So if you can prove that you are Michael by you're doing the multi-factor authentication, the second factor, I'm okay, I'll let you in. But if you're not, if you cannot prove the second factor, I'm not going to let you in, which is a great way of, you know, being very cautious. Now, you have to be careful with those policies as well, because those policies have two options. First of all, you can trigger multi-factor authentication, or you can block access. You can be very restrictive and tell, no, you're not getting in. Well, you know, there are some legitimate reasons for people to actually travel across the globe, or to have multiple locations where they log into, right? So you have to be very careful what you do there. And the idea is that you can put them in monitoring mode first so that you can see, you know, if there are any of the any of these policies being triggered, and then you can create multiple policies based on behavior. You can create a separate policy for your, you know, C-level execs that have access to very sensitive data. You can create another policy for, you know, everyone else. You can trigger multi-factor authentication at any point in time, and so forth and so on. But at least in Azure Active Directory, you've got a lot of these options where you can be very flexible from an authentication perspective. And it all boils down to protecting that identity, because that is, again, the key to your kingdom. So you can do all you want, implement all the encryption capabilities, you can do information protection, classification, and so forth and so on. But in the end, it doesn't help if I, at some point, am able to mimic you, to become you, to crack your password, get your device, or whatever it is. So that's really important. That's also one of the reasons why moving away from the cloud as well, that from an infrastructure perspective, from an on-premises perspective, the pass-to-hash problems that Microsoft has faced many, many years is really something that is addressed in Windows 10. Because Windows 10 has credential guard, device guard, which prevents, you know, the local hashes being stored as part of the change of, you know, authentication into Active Directory, to be reused and be replayed, and, you know, as such being used for someone to, you know, mimic you in the on-premises Active Directory. That's also why I buy the story. I really do. You know, newer technology is better together. If you're still on, a lot of organizations are still on Windows 7. Windows 7 was released in, what was it? What year? Were 2007, 2009, right? That's 8 years old. Drive a car that's 8 years old. That's ancient. It'll still drive. It'll still get you from point A to point B. But is that car as safe as newer cars? Well, if you're driving a tank, it probably is, but it isn't very useful, right? So with Windows 7, it's the same thing. Windows 10 protects against new threats, which Windows 7 didn't even know about, which it wasn't built from the ground up to protect against these threats. Why am I talking about Windows 10? Well, I'm talking about Windows 10 because of Windows Information Protection, right? Windows Information Protection is a feature which works on the client, but it can work together with the cloud. It allows you to do automatic classification, not yet based on Azure Information Protection. It doesn't use the same classification engine, but it is able to detect what is corporate data or what is local data based on the location from where you access the data. So if I go to my corporate SharePoint, I download a file, then that file is automatically encrypted using the encrypted file system on the device, and it's categorized as being company data, so it will not be able to leave that device. I can use these Windows Information Protection policies on the device to prevent that file from being copied over to a USB stick. And even if I would ever get it onto a USB stick, I give it to you, it's protected using that Windows Information Protection policy, using that encrypted file system, and thus becomes unusable. So we're moving away from the cloud itself, which offers a plethora of options to secure your data and your identities, and moving to other technologies as exists Windows 10. And the good thing is that a lot of third-party vendors, Mobile Iron, for instance, has the capability of managing Windows 10 devices, including mobile Windows Information Protection and the policies. So that is one of the reasons why Intune is that important. A lot of organizations that I work with look at Intune, and they look at Intune as mobile device management, and they only think mobile device management this. But in the end, it can do much more than that. WIP being one of them. Now, I'm not advocating that you should go out to your customers and tell them implement WIP, because there is problems with Windows Information Protection beyond infinity. It's a version one product. But I mean, let's be honest, it works really well. Does it prevent any form of data leakage? No. Brutally honest, if someone wants to leak data from your environment, they will find a way to leak data at some point, right? But it helps against most accidental leakages. It helps against a lot of other things. And as with Azure Information Protection, you won't be able to roll it out, you know, today and use it tomorrow. You'll have to ease into that migration. But if you're in the phase of rolling out Windows 10 today, it is a good option to look at, to keep in mind, and maybe potentially enable in the future. Because, you know, all we can look at things all we want, but one thing that you can be sure is that it will integrate more and more from an endpoint perspective, from a cloud perspective, and all the services. Tony said it earlier, don't look at Office 365 as securing Exchange or Exchange only or securing SharePoint only there. It is becoming Office 365. Same is with the Enterprise Mobility and Security Suite. Azure Active Directory is that thing that underpins all the other services. And whatever you do for one of these services automatically applies to anything else that relies on that. So once you are extending Azure Active Directory, even to on-premises, a good example, who uses Citrix NetScalers? Okay, great devices, right? Complex, but great devices, can do a lot of things, especially if you've got a Citrix environment on-premises. The latest version of the Unified Access Gateway can actually leverage Azure Active Directory to authenticate users to on-premises applications. They can generate a single portal from where you can access Office 365 and on-premises applications using Azure Active Directory. So now you get into a situation where your cloud-based identity, which can be provisioned through synchronization from on-premises, becomes a solution what you can use to authenticate to on-premises applications, to cloud applications, and maybe even third-party applications. And as we move more and more workloads into various clouds, it becomes really critical that it is really well protected, not only the data, but again, moving back to that identity. So when Microsoft is, you know, advocating the identity-driven security, then they're talking about leveraging these features. And yes, it is smart from a business perspective because you don't get all the goodies in an E3 license. Yes, you will have to, you know, reach into the pocket and get enterprise mobility suites or the secure productive enterprise. But from a security perspective, from a consultant's perspective, it is well worth going to those customers and talking to them, telling them, this is what you need. It's like, here is a very, you know, old key and here is a new key. This new key protects your house much, much better. Well, you know, you choose whatever you want. The new key is twice as expensive as the other one, but it's your choice. That's basically what it comes down to. And when you're talking to people and about their own personal life and securing their personal life, they're much easier, you know, to convince to actually, you know, buy that newer key because it protects their house. They don't look at that always in the same way when you're talking about corporate data, corporate system, corporate information. But in the end, it is the same principle, right? Mike, you had a question.
Yeah.
Or a remark.
Is there any overlap between, for example, the EMS E5 and
Well, yes and no. So, yes and no. Is there overlap? There are certain features that are in there. And again, I'm not a licensing expert. And Microsoft has done a really terrific job to make it really hard to understand, because you've got E1, E3, E5 licenses in Office 365. You've got EMS E3, EMS E5. Then you've got the standalone Azure AD P1, or Azure AD Premium P1, P2, and then all the other P1, P2 licenses. But then you've got the enterprise agreement licenses, which is the SPE E3, which is the Secure Productive Enterprise E3, which I believe includes EMS E3 in the SPE E3 license. So whatever I just said might be wrong, but it just proves that it's really complicated. So my best advice I could give you, if you're really interested in one of these features, just go talk to your licensing guy and be like, well, what license do I actually need? And because it also depends on how large you are, which type of contract you have, where you're a managed customer, and honestly, it's a jungle. It's always been, but they're simplifying. I mean, E3, E5, they're starting to become a certain streamline in there. So, anyway. Well, there's always a way that you can go to the list prices, but to be honest, and this is my experience, I mean, if you're a very small customer, 20, 25, 50 seats, then all your options are just go to the Office 365 portal, you know, get your license from there, buy, take your credit card, and you're done, right? But once you're in the enterprise or in the mid-segment market, and you've got, you know, an account manager perhaps, the discussion, or even a LAR, the discussion is entirely different. There are so many licensing options, and I don't even, you know, try to understand, because I just don't. So I just understand that if a customer comes to me and says, I've got, you know, Secure Productive Enterprise, then I know, yes, Windows 10, yes, E3, yes, this, I can do all that. That's what matters. But whether or not they have that and how much it costs, I really don't know. So. This being said, I was going to say I'm not over time, but I'm 3 minutes over time, so I'm going to leave it at that. If there is any more questions, I'm more than happy to ask them during the Ask the Experts. Anyway, thank you, and I'll talk to you guys later.